with Dr. Keith Suter.
Australia recently changed its position by supporting a UN resolution that recognises the right of Palestinians to control their resources in the occupied territories of Gaza and the West Bank. This move breaks from Australia's long-standing stance and has stirred controversy, especially among pro-Israel groups in the country. Australia, alongside 155 nations, also backed Arab control over resources in the Syrian Golan Heights, a vote it had opposed since 2003. The United States, Israel, and a few others voted against the resolution. The United States called it biased and unhelpful for peace. Australia also backed a resolution holding Israel responsible for an oil spill during the 2006 war with Lebanon. Dr. Keith Suter from Global Directions, he joins us this morning. Hello, Keith, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Brent.
Keith, why has Australia changed its stance on the UN resolution after years of opposition?
Yes, I think this represents a bit of a shifting in Australian opinion towards Israel, particularly over the recent suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. And so we see Australia now joining with two-thirds of the rest of the world in being much more critical of what Israel has done. Traditionally, Australia has been very supportive of Israel, but I think there are now signs of disquiet, shall we say, within Australia towards its almost unlimited support for Israel. And this is a sign of it. Now, this is also part of Australia's push for there to be a two-state solution, which is coming at a time when most of the people involved in Israel are no longer interested in what's called the two-state solution. Two-state solution means that there'll be area controlled by Israel and a new Palestinian authority that would cover the West Bank and Gaza. The essence of this was proposed back in the late 1930s when the British government controlled Palestine on behalf of the League of Nations. So it's not a particularly new concept, but it's a question of where you actually draw the lines. But it's interesting that the current Israeli parliament, Knesset, has decided not to support now that two-state solution. And we know that Hamas, the Palestinian group that controlled Gaza, has been opposed to it right from the outset. So we've now got the combatants on the ground not liking the two-state solution, while Australia and other countries still talk about it, but obviously there's a feeling that it's now dead in the water. But Australia, I guess, is expressing its support for there still being some sort of two-state solution.
Never say never, but it seems as though there will never be a two-state solution. So if that be the case, what are the other options then?
Well, there are a number of options. In fact, I've written about this. One would be a continuation of what we see at the moment, which is that we have periods of tranquility followed by periods of violence. And we're obviously going through a period of violence at the moment. But remember, just prior to the outbreak of the violence in Gaza, the U.S. National Security Advisor said that the Israeli situation has been as peaceful as it has been ever in recent years, where he was proved wrong a few days later with the sudden attack by Hamas. But that's the idea, that you have this escalation in violence and then it dies down for a while, then you get a fresh wave of violence. The second option would be, of course, the two-state solution, which is what a lot of people support. So territory controlled by Israel, other territory controlled by Palestine. A third solution would be to have an area of what one might call Greater Israel, which would include both the West Bank and Gaza. And in that sort of arrangement, the real problem for Israel will be the growing population of Palestinians. Palestinians are having large families, and they've traditionally done that. And of course, also within Israel, you have the Orthodox population, which was pretty well overlooked at the time of the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, but it too now is having lots of children. And the people who don't have so many children are the modern cosmopolitan Israelis, so they're going to find themselves being squeezed by the Palestinian community and the Orthodox Jewish community. But that's another option, that you just have this Greater Israel, but it'd be very difficult to control. And I also throw in a fourth scenario, which is what I call the land of milk and honey, whereby somehow the Israelis and Palestinians do find a way of living together. And the example I quote is that if you were living in England 1,000 years ago, the Scandinavians would come over for rape, pillage and murder with the Vikings, etc. And now when you think of Scandinavia, you think of the ABBA music group and Volvo cars. You don't think of rape, pillage and murder. So people can change over the years. So the Palestinians and Israelis are not destined always to be fighting each other.
How might the decision that Australia has made, how might that impact Australia's relationship with its allies, particularly the United States and Israel?
Well, in regard to Israel, clearly there are some Israelis that are very concerned about what Australia has done. You've got to bear in mind that Israel is a nation of 10 million prime ministers. So I should imagine there will be some Israelis who would have sympathy for the Australian decision, because they certainly don't have sympathy for the current Israeli government. And so, you know, you've got a diversity of opinions within Israel. But generally speaking, the official Israeli viewpoint is obviously criticism of what Australia has done. And the same, I think, with the United States. Although the US support for Israel, although the US remains firm itself, there are a dwindling number of countries that now support Israel in the past year because of all the violence against the Palestinians. And I've been surprised, by the way, I teach young Americans, and I've been surprised about how pro-Palestinian many young Americans are nowadays. You know, they've traditionally been fairly uninvolved in politics until quite recently, and now they feel fervently about what's been happening to the Palestinians.
What role do Australia's concerns about Israeli settlements and violence play in this shift of mind?
This is the real problem within Israeli politics. The settlers who go to live in the occupied West Bank, and perhaps now will also seek to reoccupy Gaza, they are obviously acting against international law. And of course, you know, you've now got more international lawyers paying attention to the behavior of Israeli governments as well as the settlers. And the settlers are an important voting bloc. They tend to be much more fundamentalist, perhaps even Orthodox Jews. They tend to be very influential in Israeli politics. And so they certainly are significant, and they are willing to live very rough lives as settlers. It's not a luxury area that they're going to. You know, they live in caravans, etc. It's a pretty rough life until you get your township fully established. But of course, it can only be established on land that is being held by Palestinians. And so you've got to push the Palestinians off their land in order for you to build your village. And this is what's caused so much international criticism of Israel. This has been going on for many years. But what is different is now the media are much more alert to this issue, and we're getting far more media coverage of what's going on. And suddenly you end up, as I say, with these young Americans outraged by what's been going on.
Keith, how have pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel groups in Australia reacted to the government's new position on this?
I haven't seen any response from the pro-Palestinian. I should imagine they'd be supportive. I think that there's been one, the Palestinian network has certainly endorsed the Australian government's viewpoint. And of course, you've got Israeli spokespeople in this country, or pro-Israeli spokespeople, who have been very critical of it. I think the advantage of Australia is that we don't get too upset about political issues. We reserve our anger for referees on a Saturday rather than taking out direct violence against each other. So it's a more tranquil environment in which to express support or criticism of the Australian government. Yes, people are angry or very supportive, but it's not reaching the levels that you would see in other countries.
Potential diplomatic challenges for Australia as a result of this decision, do you see any?
No, I don't think so. I think that the Americans realise that a lot of their other allies have also got concerns about the fate of the Palestinians. Now, Donald Trump will be much more pro-Israeli than even Biden has been, and Biden has been very pro-Israeli. But I don't think Trump's going to start punishing Australia. He's going to have to go after other allies as well. And Trump, of course, has a need for Australia because of the looming conflict with China. So he's in a bit of a dilemma himself. And remember, he's trying to get out of foreign commitments rather than digging deeper into them.
You talked about other solutions, and you said there's been times of war and there's been times of peace. Can I ask you, what is the longest time of war that we've seen in the past?
Well, the wars nowadays tend to be fairly quick, that you can't, because of the what's called the capital intensive nature of war. In other words, it's no longer wars involving huge numbers of people, usually men, attacking each other. It's now very capital intensive. So you've got expensive equipment, expensive ammunition. If you look at, for example, at the Ukrainian situation, one of the reasons why Trump's team want to pull out of supporting Ukraine is they're simply running out of ammunition. They've given so much ammunition to Ukraine that if China were to cause problems with Taiwan, the United States could only fight China for a few weeks. So that the United States has to pull back and sort of replenish its supplies of ammunition. So wars tend to be over and done with now within about 6 weeks, unless you get dragged into a guerrilla conflict, which is what we're seeing at the moment in Gaza. So that war has gone on now for over a year, and Israel still has not completely defeated Hamas within Gaza. So that's the risk you run, is you get bogged down in a guerrilla struggle, as the Americans found in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Russians found in Afghanistan as well. So you either fight a short, intensive conventional war, which is generally what has happened with Israel taking on its Arab enemies, or you get bogged down in a long-term guerrilla conflict where guerrillas can keep on losing the battles and yet still win the war, because the modern industrial country on the other side just gets tired of all of this and runs out of ammunition or runs out of other equipment. So Israel has now been fighting for over a year in Gaza and has still not managed to defeat Hamas.
You touched on the Ukraine-Russian situation. I see that I read a report that there are as many as up to 50,000 Chinese troops going to Russia. We've seen
North Korean.
North Korean. Yes, North Korean. Chinese. Yep. North Korean troops going to Russia. 50,000 North Korean troops going to Russia. Can I ask you, what difference is this huge number of soldiers from North Korea going to make to this conflict between Ukraine and Russia?
Yeah, this is a very serious development indeed. We now have an Asian dimension to a European conflict. And so the Korean troops, we assume that they're going to be around that what's called the Kerch salient, which is actually in Russia, where the Ukrainians have successfully invaded Russia and taken over part of the Russian territory. They're going to be trying to remove the Ukrainian troops from that. It's very serious in the sense that North Korea, although it has a huge standing army, that army has not had much experience in fighting because there's been an armistice on the Korean Peninsula since 1953. Now they're getting battle-hardened experience. Unfortunately, the Russian way of fighting is that you just keep throwing men into the meat grinder, so they're losing people at the rate of about 1,000 a week to either being wounded or being killed. So it won't take too long to grind their way through all those poor North Korean troops who've been deployed. But you know, North Korea is showing that it's willing to support Russia. It's no longer so closely associated with China. It now sees another ally in Russia. And additionally, there is the issue that the North Koreans will use this as an advertisement for their own troops being deployed elsewhere. Because in a sense, the North Koreans can say to, say, African dictators, if you're having problems, hire some North Korean troops. Obviously, as mercenaries, the money will go to the North Korean government rather than the North Korean soldiers themselves. But it'll be a way for the North Koreans to assert themselves in international affairs and also for a way to make money for the North Korean regime. So this is a very significant development indeed. And it's worrying to South Korea because the troops in North Korea who survive in Ukraine will come back and they will be battle hardened. It may well be that South Korea will start supplying equipment to Ukraine as a way of replying to North Korea's involvement. So we now see an escalation of the war in Ukraine.
But Donald Trump will save us all, according to him. It's funny, isn't it? I mean, Trump has gained full control of the US government with the Republicans winning the House and the Senate.
Yes, indeed. So he's now got, at least for 2 years, a good way to run the US government. And he's already keeping his promise. You know, he's not going to put in old Republican figures from the establishment. He's putting in some really wild cards. Matt Gaetz, as Attorney General, for example, is a person with allegations about his personal behavior. You've got a person going in as the defense secretary who's got very little experience in defense matters, although he's been a soldier, but he hasn't really run a large corporation. He works in the media. So Trump is keeping his promise by not relying on the deep state to provide the ministers in the cabinet. Now, he says he's going to be able to solve these conflicts within a day. I don't think he's going to be able to do that. But he will certainly seek to withdraw America from most of its international agreements. I don't think that he will pull out of AUKUS, the Australia, United States, United Kingdom defense arrangement, because AUKUS is very much in tune with his hostility towards China. Forget Russia as a problem for the Americans. The real problem is China. And we will see increased tensions against China. It's interesting to note that in the last few hours, the Chinese leader has actually commended the Australian Prime Minister as setting a good example for other countries. It shows we've got a fresh new friend in China.
Good-looking,
you know, bearing in mind the hostility that they did for our red wine and our lobsters, etc. Now, suddenly, it's become our best friend.
All right, Keith, we will leave it there. As always, we thank you for taking the time out of your Saturday morning to talk to us, and we look forward to chatting with you again.
Yes, thank you very much, Brent.
That's Dr. Keith Suter from Global Directions.